Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in for Steve Goldstein. Later this hour, a look at Governor Brewer's plan to financially reward schools whose students improve their performance and why making friends at the office could help you do your job better. But first, Phoenix hasn't had a full-time city manager since David Cavazos left last year to take a similar position in Santa Ana, California. The Phoenix City Council will take a step towards changing that today when it votes for a new city manager. Arizona Republic reporter Amy B. Wang will be at this afternoon's meeting and joins me now. Amy, welcome.
Hi, Mark.
So tell us about the four finalists, two of whom are local and some of our listeners may have heard of, two of whom are from out of state.
Sure. Yes, Phoenix has narrowed it down to four finalists. The two internal candidates are Rick Neymark and Ed Durker. Rick has been with the city, like you mentioned, for 27 years. Ed is actually the acting city manager right now and has been since Cavazos left, and he has been with the city for 21 years. The two external candidates are Milton Dehoney Jr. and Deanna Santana. Milton Dehoney was for, I believe, 7 years the city manager of Cincinnati, Ohio, and he stepped down last fall with the arrival of a new mayor in that city. And Santana is the city administrator of Oakland, California. So that's more or less the equivalent position to city manager here.
So give us a quick recap of what exactly Phoenix's city manager does.
Phoenix has a mayor-council form of government. So the city manager here acts essentially as a chief executive or CEO. He or she is responsible for things like overseeing day-to-day operations, hiring and firing employees, implementing this council's budget. The council and the mayor act more like the board of directors. So the city manager plays a very important role in Phoenix.
Do you get the sense from either city staff or city council members themselves that there's a preference for either an in-house candidate or maybe they just want a fresh start after all the controversy that accompanied Cavazos and his departure?
You know, I've talked to several council members over the last week, and, you know, there definitely is, I've gotten word on both sides. You know, people do say there are a lot of issues the new city manager is going to have to be able to hit the ground running and tackle, and in that sense, maybe an internal candidate would be more suited for that. That said, there are also council members who think that the city could use a pair of fresh eyes to look at the problems the city's facing and to bring new ideas. So I think it could go either way. We'll just have to wait and see how they decide this afternoon.
And as you say, there are some problems facing the city. Whoever takes this job will not be sort of walking into the world's easiest situation. Among the problems are the city's budget problems. What kinds of issues would the new city manager have to be dealing with?
Right. Well, short term, like you mentioned, Phoenix is facing anywhere from a $26 million to a $52 million budget deficit for the coming fiscal year. And now, just to put that into some perspective, Mark, when David Cavazos came on board as city manager, Phoenix was facing a $277 million budget deficit. So it's not, some would say, as dire as it was 4 years ago, but this deficit does come after 3 years of fairly upbeat projections. So I think it's caught several city leaders by surprise. That's one issue.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Clearly, the budget is not the only complication that the new city manager will have to be dealing with.
Right. And, right now, the city leaders are also in the process of negotiating new labor agreements with the Phoenix's employee unions. And these are two-year contracts that go into effect July 1st. And union leaders are across the board asking for the cuts that they've taken over the past 4 years to be restored. And because of the budget shortfall that we just mentioned, there's going to be some extra scrutiny on what goes into those agreements, and restoring those cuts might be a little bit more difficult than expected. So the new city manager is going to have to be someone who can navigate that negotiation process with the labor groups smoothly.
Do you get the sense that the vote is going to be unanimous? Do council members hope that it's unanimous? Does it matter if it's unanimous?
Well, technically speaking, of course, the majority wins, so it doesn't necessarily matter if it is unanimous. I I'm not sure. I get the sense right now that there are several council members who are leaning in one direction or another, but they're really going into today's session. They're interviewing final candidates right now with trying to go in with an open mind. So, again, we'll just have to wait and see. The council meeting is scheduled for 3 p.m. today when they're expected to make their decision or announce their decision. And we'll see if it was unanimous or not.
And as you said, the council members are interviewing the final candidates now. Any sense of what kinds of questions council members might want to hear answers to from these finalists?
Well, like I said, those two short-term issues that I mentioned, the budget and the union group negotiations, they'll probably be looking carefully to see how they would approach those problems. Long-term, a few council members have said, I think that they're looking for a strong, steady leader, someone who can stabilize the budget for now, but also, I think, look 5, 10, 20 years down the road. This is going to maybe include a deep look at how Phoenix might reform its pension system, but also keep an eye on job growth and economic development for the city, how Phoenix can ensure that it doesn't continue to lose big opportunities to the surrounding suburbs. And also, finally, in a more traditional city manager role, the new person is going to have to build a strong team, boost employee morale, and then continue to try to find more efficient ways to operate as a city.
And after the city votes, the council will say, okay, this is the person we want. Then the task of negotiating a contract and getting that person to actually take the job are beginning, right?
Right, right. They will likely announce their choice today, but the contract is certainly not set in stone. Things like salary for the new city manager and benefits will be, I think, negotiated over the next week or so.
Amy B. Wang is a reporter for the Arizona Republic and will be at this afternoon's Phoenix City Council meeting. Amy, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Amy referenced Phoenix's budget problems. It's something that could come up during Mayor Greg Stanton's State of the City address next month. Mayors across the valley have been delivering their annual municipal assessments and will continue to do so. Glendale Mayor Jerry Weyer's speech, for example, is next week. So how are cities doing? To find out, we welcome Ken Strobeck. He's the executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
So how are cities doing? What is the state of Valley Cities?
Well, I was thinking about that after you asked me the question earlier, and I think I would characterize it as cautiously optimistic, but with some figurative and literal potholes in the road.
Okay, so what are the literal? I mean, I guess we know what the literal potholes are. What are the figurative ones?
Well, the figurative ones are ones that Amy just mentioned. Those things such as benefit increases, health care, pensions. Those are things that are obviously in the news a lot and are rapidly increasing more than revenues are increasing. Revenues are coming back from the recession. We should be clear about that, but they're not coming back as fast as some of those other costs are increasing, as well as the fact that, for a long time, city employees have been either flat or on very, very limited salary increases. There's now some pressure from both unionized organizations as well as a number of cities and towns that are non-union, but to actually start giving some salary increases to their employees. So that's adding in. And then as the literal potholes are things such as deferred maintenance, technology increasing, keeping up with new computers and particularly with road and street maintenance.
Actual potholes. So, when you talk to folks at the Capitol, for example, there's generally a sense of, okay, we've sort of weathered the storm. The worst is behind us. We might be in for another little dip here or there, but it's not going to be as bad as it was. Is that the general sense with cities as well? Or it sounds like they might be a bit more concerned.
I think there may be a bit more concern at the local level, just because, when you're talking about the state, you're looking at the entire economy of a very large state. City by city, things could be better or worse, depending on where you happen to be located and what the attractions or the capabilities are of cities. Home building for so long was the number one driver of many of our municipal economies, and now home building is coming back to some extent, but not nearly to the degree that it was before, and that's probably a very good thing. But that's also very spotty. There are a lot of communities that are either built out or are close to being built out, or it's just cost prohibitive to build. But in fact, in some areas, there's some infill going on, where they're taking lots that maybe were not built on, that are in a more urbanized area, doing more infill there. So it's not the huge developments. It's more, project by project kind of construction.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Ken Strobeck of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Phoenix obviously is having its financial problems and being sort of the anchor of the valley, the capital city, the biggest city in the state. How much do the problems that Phoenix has sort of ripple throughout the rest of the valley and affect other valley cities?
Well, it's like what I was talking about. I think definitely Phoenix being the by far the largest community certainly has an impact, but there are other cities that are doing things like Phoenix is in terms of trying to attract new development, economic development. We've seen, obviously, the big news of Mesa landing the Apple company. Tempe has done very well with this new State Farm facility and some of those other recruitments for jobs and economic development. And that's really where the emphasis is now, is let's look at what we can do positively to attract jobs, to build the economy, to get that whole rising tide going again so we can all recover.
Another of the cities that's had some problems that have been fairly public is Glendale, with everything going on with the Coyotes and the revenue and the spring training facility, Camelback Ranch, and the debt on that. Glendale, for a while, was sort of the rising star of the West Valley, almost like the Phoenix of the West Valley. I'm sure Glendale mm-hmm. leaders would not like to hear it referred to that way, but exactly metaphorically. So, I mean, much like Phoenix's problems potentially impact the rest of the valley, do Glendale's have a similar impact?
I'd say not really. There's not a lot of spillover because of what happened specifically in Glendale with, as you mentioned, the investments in those sports facilities. And, it's very ironic that the economy just happened to hit the downturn right at the time when all those things were coming due for major payments. If we had been a few years different in that cycle, Glendale might have been riding high, might have been the most prosperous community in the entire state, and everybody would have said, wow, why didn't we follow that model? It just timing was bad for some of those investments that they made.
Would you say that cities outside the valley are basically in the same situation as cities within the valley?
I'd say yes, with a few exceptions. Most of them didn't go through the big boom that we had in the valley with housing to begin with. So when the downturn came, they weren't as negatively affected as valley cities were. And also, they just tend to be a little less volatile when their economies are based on either mining or agriculture or those kinds of things that just go on a more regular basis in other parts of the state. Now, I will say there are a couple of exceptions, like in Taylor, where there was a paper mill that was really critical for the entire regional economy. That closed down, and that's had a big effect up in that part of the northeast part of the state, and other places where there are, single industries that maybe are either thriving or in decline. But in general, I think the rural areas are less volatile than the cities here in the valley.
We have about 30 seconds left, so I know this is going to be a tough question to answer in that amount of time. Are there particular bills going through the legislature now that concern you as far as helping cities continue to recover or maybe impeding that recovery?
Absolutely. In fact, state legislation on impact fees and the TPT bill last year have had an impact
that
on
was
our
the
local
sales,
economy.
The sales tax.
Sales tax, yes. And now this year, we're very concerned about this exemption of tax on electricity for manufacturing. Right now, it's really broad, has a big impact. We think it needs to be narrowed significantly so that cities and towns aren't hurt by that.
Ken Strobeck is the Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Ken, thanks.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Here and Now, what's in Governor Brewer's school performance funding plan and will it improve student performance? And later this hour, how having friends at the office could help your work performance. That and more still to come on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Country Day School Summer Programs, offering summer fun with arts, sports, and academics for children from kindergarten through high school, June 9th through July 18th. Program details at pcds.org/summer.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. BBC News Hour comes your way at 1. Checking temperatures around the state right now, it's partly sunny and 52 degrees at the Grand Canyon. Sunny skies, 55 degrees in Flagstaff. Cloudy and 70 degrees in Tucson. Cloudy and 71 in Yuma. Now you can hear great classic jazz whenever you want it right here in Phoenix. It's at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Explore more at jazz.kjzz.org. Partly sunny skies and 70 degrees in Phoenix at 11:21.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. As part of her budget proposal, Governor Jan Brewer is asking state lawmakers for about $37.5 million. It's for a program her office is calling Student Success Funding. It's basically a performance funding plan that would give cash to schools for high-performing students and students whose performance improves. Dale Frost is the governor's education policy advisor.
So the Student Success Funding program is, first and foremost, just trying to change the discussion. Right now in the legislature, we have heated debates about education funding every year, and it's a debate about less versus more. And what we're trying to say is not only should we be debating funding levels, less versus more, but also how to make sure that we reward, incentivize the great work that's happening in our school districts, in our charter schools, etc. And it's a very simple proposal in that those schools, it's about $40 million that we calculate, and those schools that show improvement and high achievement with their students would be able to earn extra dollars on top of the existing funding system.
And logistically now, how would this work? I mean, how would the money be doled out? How would you measure achievement versus reaching an excellent point?
We have a state assessment. We're moving to a new state assessment, and that's used for our accountability system. You may have heard of our A through F labels. So what builds those A through F labels are, at an individual student level, their achievement profile in the state assessment, whether they are at grade level, they exceed grade level, or are below. And then what's called a student growth percentile, which is a measurement of their improvement from year to year compared to their academic peers.
So this is really a student-by-student kind of looking here.
Right. Last year we had a performance funding proposal. We started the discussion. It was based on district and charter school letter grade. So it was a very high level measurement of quality, and we think those are still important. But we didn't have flexibility to weight improvement versus achievement because that's already set in the calculation. So we said, okay, how do we take this down to the individual student level so we also don't create the unintended consequence of sometimes having the incentive be to not help certain children versus helping them? We wanted the incentive to be schools, if you help move every child forward, you will be rewarded for that each and every time that happens. And so the way it works is basically, let me give you two examples, two students. You have a student who's way far behind, let's say a sixth grader reading at second grade level. If they get the help they need, extra tutoring, great teacher, these kind of things, and let's say by seventh grade they're now reading at a fifth grade level, that student could be earning $200 for their school, for example. Let's say you had another student that was at in the same case, but didn't find that improved barely or just a little bit, they wouldn't be earning dollars under this proposal. If you had a student that was scoring well above grade level and showed that same kind of growth, they could earn $80 for their school, and if they didn't, they'd earn $25. So if you're below grade level, you have to show above average growth, but those are where the real dollars are. For all students above grade level, they can earn dollars, and growth is still weighted heavily.
Are you looking at just test scores on this, or would anything else go into the calculations for how much money, if any, a school might get per student?
So for grades, kindergarten through 11, it's based on assessment. For 12th grade, our outcome is graduation. So we don't have an assessment. You must graduate the child, and every time they graduate, the school earns $40 under our proposal.
Now, last year, you referenced the governor put forth a similar kind of plan. I mean, it was different in terms of how it would work. Obviously, you got some pushback on that. It didn't become law. The legislature mm-hmm. didn't approve it. What did you take from last year's discussion to incorporate into a plan that obviously you're hoping has a better outcome this year?
So I'd like to clarify one thing. The legislature put a down payment of $2.4 million to continue the conversation. So it wasn't a complete wash. We got some traction, but it's a big enough idea of how changing how you fund schools, at least in part in the future, that we wanted to do this right. So from the school's perspective, one of their main concerns, the first one was, does this disadvantage schools in lower income areas? And there was a lot of disagreement about that. But this proposal, we intentionally built it so that was not the case. The next concern that schools had last year was that part of the funding was from existing funds. It was reallocated to this. And so if you didn't show the performance, you could actually have funding go down. That was a concern. This is all new dollars. So with those two things off the table, those concerns met, now we can debate the merits of the proposal, which is, do you fund purely based on students in seats, whether they're learning or not, or should a part of that funding be based on how much they are learning and how well they are succeeding?
The money that districts would be able to earn from this, are there limitations on what those schools or districts could use the money for?
So our position is no, that we should let that be a local decision. So we had talked about how individual student outcomes generate the dollars, but that would be summed up and given to the district as a lump sum. And the district would, or charter school, would be able to choose how they spend those dollars, be it technology, curriculum, staff bonuses. And the idea is they've earned the money. They should figure out how to use the money to continue to improve performance.
Philosophically, is there a concern that when you incentivize teachers or schools or districts to try to improve like this, that there's an implicit suggestion that they weren't trying to improve student outcomes without this financial incentive?
We've gotten that question a lot. When you have a teacher performance pay structure, I think that's a more valid concern. The intention is not to try to make teachers work harder. The governor, for example, the governor knows that the vast majority of teachers are out there working really hard, doing everything they can, same for principals and superintendents. What we believe is that there are local policies that can only be determined at the local level rather than mandates from Phoenix that should be changed, that sometimes are politically difficult, and this gives them the extra push to make that happen.
Dale Frost is Governor Jan Brewer's education policy advisor. Dale, thanks.
Thank you very much.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. For another perspective on the governor's student success funding proposal, we turn to Pearl Chang Esau. She's the president and CEO of the group Expect More Arizona, which advocates for a world-class education system for all Arizona students. Pearl, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what do you think about this idea that the governor has put forward about a new performance funding model for schools?
Yeah, well, we think that it's a pretty good move from in the right direction from last year's proposal. Last year, they were taking a look at a model where they would take existing funding and redistribute it based on the student success funding formula. And they were taking a look at appropriating the money based on a district's letter grade. And the changes that they've made this year, we think, are in the right direction. You know, now they're looking at taking new funding, which is critical because schools have already had a lot of funding cut from them over the last few years. And they're taking a look at student growth percentiles. So instead of taking success at a district level, which could be pretty removed from a teacher's classroom, they're taking a look at how individual students are growing and improving.
Yeah, how important is it that there's a component in there that doesn't just reward schools whose students are already doing well?
Well, that's absolutely critical. I mean, when you think about the students who are going to need the most support and the most interventions, often they're students who face an achievement gap. They're students from low-income background, often disproportionately students of color. And so if we want to create incentives for teachers who are really doing a great job, you know, we need to look at the teachers who are doing the very hard work of closing those achievement gaps. And often that means that, you know, a student might be improving, although today they may not be excelling, you know, that they're on track to getting there.
Do you think that financial incentives will really make a difference as far as helping students who are not doing what they should be doing or what they need to be doing do that?
Sure. I mean, we think financial incentives can absolutely make a difference in terms of creating a culture of excellence, you know, really thinking about how to create that focus on making sure that we're always making progress, we're always improving. But I think also the really important thing is having a great principal and a great teacher. You know, at the end of the day, great principals and great teachers are going to focus on doing what they already do, which is creating that culture of excellence and making sure they're always on track to learn from their experiences and get better at teaching their kids. So, I mean, we really think that the bigger priority here is making sure that schools have a sufficient amount of funding to help the improvement of all students. So, you know, the incentive part can make a difference, but I think we need to take a step back and look at that bigger picture of overall funding for education. You know, it's been cut by almost 20% over the last 5 years.
More base funding, things like soft capital, things for computers and textbooks and things like that, and other kinds of base funding, sounds like what you're saying.
Well, I think that in order to have incentives make a difference, we need to start with operating an environment where we have sufficient resources to meet kids' basic needs, to make sure that all kids are improving. So we need to look at the whole education funding system and look at how do we increase the size of that pie overall.
One of the things that the governor's office is saying is that, you know, schools that get this money, that has kids graduate or meet certain performance thresholds or improvement thresholds, the schools can basically use the money for whatever they want. If they want to give teacher bonuses, great. If they want to buy textbooks, great. Whatever they want to do. Does that help, in your mind, the problem of some of the base funding cuts that schools and districts have had over the past several years?
I think that it helps. But again, back to if we want to help, if we're truly committed in Arizona to helping all students succeed, that means that we need to commit to getting schools and teachers the resources that they need with no strings attached. So if I'm a teacher, I'm a principal, and I'm constantly worried about my kids' performances on test scores, which is primarily how this funding is going to be appropriated, you know, that might actually put my focus in the wrong place. You know, I think it would be better if I was focused on that as an incentive on top of all the great work that was already happening to make sure that, you know, my students were performing. Having sufficient funds for education is a key part to making sure that our teachers and principals can operate in a healthy context, so that on top of that, they can really implement an incentive-based, performance-based culture that's going to make a difference.
If this incentive plan were to go into effect, do you think that it would change how teachers and principals and other educators do their jobs?
You know, I have to say, I think most teachers and principals in Arizona, the vast majority, are doing an incredible job. I mean, they really work very, very hard. And if anything, we really need to be investing in their professional development so that they can be the kinds of teachers and principals that we need that know how to get their kids on a track to excellence. You know, a lot of times it isn't for lack of effort. Sometimes it's for lack of maybe knowing what the best practices are, or, you know, hey, 50% of the kids in our school are transient, or, you know, maybe a whole bunch of them came and they didn't know English. You know, we have a lot of rural and remote places in Arizona. Often there's only one school and there's very, very limited resources. So I think that it's about making sure that we support our educators in getting the training they need to be excellent.
You said that, in your mind at least, this year's proposal for performance funding is better than last year's. Are there things that you would like to try to tweak about it, or the things that you think could make this plan even better in your mind?
I really think the changes that were made were very positive. You know, I think it makes sense. To the best of our ability, if we're going to base funding on performance, we're doing the right thing by looking at student growth. But again, you know, I think the priority is taking that bigger picture view. You know, it'll be great if we get more funding to school. If it's performance-based, okay, that could help. But we have to take that bigger picture look and say, but our kids aren't achieving at the levels that we want them to in Arizona. And so we've got to look at our investment strategy differently. And that's a combination of probably one part looking at our existing funding and how we spend that, because we spend billions of dollars on education. You know, are we using that as effectively as we could? And the other part of it is, probably other two parts of it is, you know, how do we create a bigger pie? How do we make sure that we have the overall resources that we need for supporting our teachers?
Pearl Chang Esau is the president and CEO of Expect More Arizona. Pearl, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Another group following this issue is the Helios Education Foundation. Paul Luna is its president and CEO. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell me what you think of the governor's performance funding proposal that she's put out.
Well, I think it's important to understand that the governor's proposal does a number of things. And it's great to begin to have discussion and dialogue from an education perspective in terms of what I think really the governor's objective is how do we start to put the focus on ensuring that we are valuing performance and accountability, especially from a student perspective. And I think that's a very positive message that is being championed, in particular with this proposal from the governor's office.
So that's sort of the theoretical. How about the actual practical? I mean, what do you think that this program would achieve some of the things that a group like yours would hope it would achieve?
Well, I think that's to be determined, to be perfectly honest with you. I think that there are some, there has been some evolution in this proposal over the last couple of years that I've been aware of. And I think that the feedback and input that seems to have helped to guide the evolution of the proposal, I think is positive. I think there are some questions. I think, we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge and recognize that there's no guarantee that, where you put something out there that you know exactly what's going to happen. But I think the rationale behind it, I think the overall philosophy and what it's trying to do, I think sends the right message from an education perspective.
What are some of the bigger questions that you have about it?
I think, one of the things I would share about Helios Education Foundation in terms of the work that we do, and I think is really kind of one of our core values, is the importance of ensuring that we are able to provide a quality education to every child. And so, not that I know exactly what this impact would be, but I think we would always want to make sure that we know how is this type of incentive performance pay going to resonate across the entire state. Is it truly going to help every child? Is it going to help every type of school, regardless of what kind of social economic status that school district might be in? I'm born and raised in Miami, Arizona, so I'm a rural Arizona kid. And so I would ask the question, how is this going to play out in my hometown? Is this going to have the type of benefit in improving student performance in rural Arizona in the same way that it will in urban centers? So I think those are the questions that we have to ask.
Do you think that this money, this approximately $40 million that the governor has requested for this program, would that be better used as a sort of base education funding and not as a separate new program?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure I could tell you that I know one way or another. What I would say is, it's an investment in education. It's more money for education. The fact that it's being separated a little bit and some performance criteria is being placed to that, well, I think this is where the governor and some of her supporters are really trying to provide some leadership around sending a message of what we want to do to begin to reform education in our state. And I think that's a good message. I would focus in on the fact that just in general, I think we as a state would be better served if we invested in education in a more meaningful way overall. And I think if we started to do both, invest in the general education system, really looking at enhancing and raising performance with increased funding, I think that's really what we need to get to.
Is there a concern on your part that a performance funding plan might not reach rural areas, might not reach low-income areas as much as it might reach some higher-income areas?
I'm not sure if I would say it that way. I guess what I would say is what we don't really know is how the incentives that are in place with this proposal are going to play out in every type of community. And I think we should be very mindful of that. I think the intent is that increased performance of students is going to be rewarded. And that's going to be regardless of what kind of school district you're in or what type of community you're from. But the importance is to make sure that we monitor it and that we know and understand exactly how it plays out.
Do you think that financial incentives are the best way to try to increase student performance?
I think that's a tougher one to answer. I don't think it's the sole answer. Like in many things, money isn't the driving solution towards many issues that we try to address from a community perspective. However, financial incentives oftentimes can provide either the lift or the incentive that you need to actually progress towards something, where it's something very tangible that you can measure. I think in combination with many other factors that generally we know to help students improve, including first and foremost, how do we, quite frankly, just begin to change the culture of our state to really value education? I would say the most important thing we could do is to make education our number one priority, that every single person say, what do I do or what can I do to help improve education, improve our student performance, that will have as significant an impact as any financial support.
Based on conversations you've had with other people in education, foundations, people in schools, what kind of reaction have you heard from folks about this idea?
Well, as I think we shared earlier, this has been sort of a work in progress for a little bit of time. So there has been some feedback. I think there has been some, some questions or concerns, some misunderstandings, some unknowns. So I think you get some mixed reaction. I think like with anything, when you introduce change and when you start to tie dollars to particular types of performance standards and you don't know exactly what that's going to look like, you're going to raise some uncertainty and some anxiety. I think what it gets back to is we have to make sure that we are dealing with facts, we're sharing the information appropriately, we're clear about what we're trying to achieve, and try to have open, honest dialogue in the community to make sure that we're progressing forward in a positive manner.
Paul Luna, President and CEO of the Helios Education Foundation. Paul, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, the rise of natural food markets and why making friends at the office could make you a better employee. That's still ahead as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Dignity Health, with an online ER waiting service at its member hospitals, St. Joseph's, Chandler Regional, and Mercy Gilbert. DignityHealthArizona.org.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. We should see a partly cloudy to partly sunny afternoon in the valley today. High in the low 80s is what we're expecting. Clear skies overnight with a low around 53. It'll be sunny on Thursday with a high of 76. Coming up at 12 o'clock, it's NPR's Here and Now from Boston. As the Sochi Games continue, we'll meet an athlete who was denied the chance to compete in Moscow because of the U.S. boycott in 1980, and a report on the effort to raise the minimum wage. That's NPR's Here and Now from Boston, today at noon on KJZZ. Partly sunny skies and 70 degrees in Phoenix. It's 11:42.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Good morning. I'm Mark Brody in for Steve Goldstein. But before Steve left, he spoke to a couple of experts about the proliferation and success of natural food stores.
For years, we'd be asked whether we want a paper or plastic bag for our groceries. At some stores, though, the more appropriate question may be quinoa or couscous. The so-called natural food markets, such as Whole Foods and Sprouts, didn't start carving out a healthy space in the overall industry until the past decade or so. In the new book, Natural Profits, former marketing officer for both Whole Foods and Sprouts, Joe Dobrow, recaps the history and how natural markets went mainstream. Joe, how did we move from co-ops, where some middle-class folks wouldn't go inside for fear of smelling like hemp, to where we're at now? Who or what turned that part of the business around?
In our accessible lifetimes, if you go back to our grandparents' generation, everything, almost everything, was natural and organic. We just didn't call it that. It didn't have those labels. But the world had not yet invented all of these different synthetic additives, and you didn't have as many pesticides and preservatives and things like that out there. This all changed very quickly and very dramatically right at the end of World War II, because as all of that industrial machinery that had been geared up to producing ammunition and war material and weaponry needed to be converted into something else, much of it was converted into agriculture. So in 1945, DDT, which had been a military tool, was released for public use, and it very quickly became the most popular pesticide in the United States. And on its heels came about 80,000 new chemical compounds and 5,000 new additives into food, all kinds of emulsifiers and colorings and preservatives and sweeteners and things like that. In the space of a decade and a half, you know, through the late 40s up until the early 60s, let's say, that pendulum swung completely in the opposite direction. And whereas we had had this world that was all natural and organic, now we had this world that was all synthetic. Mostly, people didn't care. Well, there were some people who cared. And these were some of the children of the 60s. They'd been born in the early years of the baby boom. And so these were folks like Mo Siegel, who ended up creating Celestial Seasonings Tea, or Gene Kahn, who founded Cascadian Farm, or John Mackey from Whole Foods Market. Mm-hmm. And these guys grew up during the 60s, rebelling against everything and rebelling in large part against the business establishment that had given them this twisted food system in which not only were there artificial and synthetic additives and everything, but we didn't know it because there were no food labeling laws to stipulate that we would know it. So they ended up creating these companies that they really had no roadmap at first. Nobody told them, how do you create a yogurt company? How are you going to build a natural foods retailing empire? there weren't things like that. You had said there were these kind of backwater health food stores, and not only did you walk out of there smelling like hemp, you probably went in there smelling like hemp too. Wood slat floors and bulk bins full of honey and peanut butter and brown rice and tofu, and yeah, mainstream America would not go anywhere near this. So this group sort of had to figure this out and say, you know, we think that there's a huge opportunity here, but we've got to figure out how to get to mass. We've got to figure out how to legitimize it, how to package it right, how to limit the price differential, and how to educate people as to why they would buy these things.
Considering that the food industry, supermarket industry, was probably doing pretty darn well with the all the additives and synthetic stuff, how much more of a challenge was it to get people to decide to buy into this natural thing? Well, we don't really, because it wasn't a point of need yet in some sense.
They tried every trick in the book, doing crazy, wacky promotional stunts. And you know, there's a story in the book about how Stonyfield Farm heard a radio program in the morning where the guy said, you know, I'd rather eat camel manure than yogurt. And so Gary Hirschberg drives up to Benson's Animal Park in New Hampshire and fills a yogurt cup with camel manure and brings it into the radio station and turns this guy around. You had to do that back in those days because there was no legitimacy to the industry. But I will tell you, and frequently it was outside events that ended up tipping things. So, for example, in 1989, we had the Alar crisis. Alar was this chemical treatment that was used on a lot of different produce, but in particular apples. It had been suspect as a possible carcinogen, and there had been a lot of government reports, but those had been suppressed. There was a report that came out from the NRDC, the National Resource Defense Council, early in 1989 that stated that there could be as many as 6,000 school children who would die from cancer because of their consumption of apple products. And on February 26th of 1989, 60 Minutes jumped into the fray.
The most potent cancer-causing agent in our food supply is a substance sprayed on apples to keep them on the trees longer and make them look better. That's the conclusion of a number of scientific experts. And who is most at risk? Children who may someday develop cancer from this one chemical called dimethizide.
And they aired this piece called A is for Apple, and it was highly controversial. That event was one of those seminal moments in the industry that all the efforts of the Gary Hirschbergs and the Mo Siegels and the John Mackeys never could have predicted, but that really galvanized the mainstream shopper into fear that they didn't really know what they were eating and that maybe there was a safer way out there.
It does seem like in the 21st century, places like a Whole Foods really are seeming to be said in the same breath with a Safeway or a Fry's, the more conventional market. But can you talk a little bit about market share plus whether there has been a bigger chunk in the last 10 years or so?
Think back to that pendulum now. We go from 100% natural and organic to almost 0% natural and organic. And now, after 30 years of this industry just working as hard as it could and scoring a lot of victories, we're only about 5 to 6% of the way back. So of every $100 spent on food out there, maybe $5.50, $6 is natural and organic. Now, it continues to grow very, very fast, and it is predicted that by the end of this decade, we'll probably be at 10 to 12%. That's happening, though, not because of Whole Foods, not because of Sprouts. That's happening because of Fry's. That's happening because of Kroger, their parent company, and Safeway and the others. Because, I mean, they've got 95 out of every 100 customers out there. So the fact that they have now finally turned their attention to the successes that have been created in the natural foods industry and said, hey, we're not going to lose out on that anymore. So they've created their own private label brands that are natural and organic. They've devoted a lot more floor space to natural and organic foods. You go into a Fry's store nowadays and you see this brand called Simple Truth. This brand did not exist at the beginning of 2012. They created it to roll up some of the little private label brands that they had already created. By the end of 2012, it was already at $1 billion. Kroger came out with a statement that said that if you could somehow siphon off all of the natural and organic food sales from their company and create a dedicated company out of that, it would easily be the second largest natural foods company in the U.S.
Wow.
You think about those numbers. You've got Whole Foods at maybe $12 billion, Sprouts at $2.5 billion. you can interpolate and think that that means that Fry's or Kroger as the parent company is probably doing, you know, $6-7 billion of sales in natural and organic foods nowadays.
Scottsdale resident Joe Dobrow. His new book about natural markets is called Natural Profits. He'll have a book signing on Friday night at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. As Joe Dobrow explained, natural markets or natural products at supermarkets are seeing increased sales. But is that growth being seen in a particular region, say the Southwest or West, for example? Meg Major is chief content editor for the Progressive Grocer publication.
You could certainly point to the West as the foundation for maybe the organic and natural movement. But I would certainly tell you that the movement is growing rapidly nationally. So it would no longer be safe to say that it would only be contained in, you know, fast growth pocket would be West. That would not be correct. It would be, to, you know, we're tracking strong growth of the organic and natural market as just booming in all parts of the country, mostly because organics have gone mainstream, with estimates as high as 59% of shoppers now buying organic food in conventional grocery stores.
Meg, as natural food sales become more common, are we going to see competitive prices so that food is accessible to all or most income levels?
I do think as more information is being sought from consumers who are really trying to take control of their dietary choices for themselves and their families. And I do think that that's a big operative word in this discussion, that there are so many things that consumers can't control in terms of price fluctuations. And I think with the heightened awareness of free from foods, allergies, et cetera, for people to be able to have much more opportunities in conventional markets as well as especially natural grocers, who've continued to really, you know, set a very high bar for conventional grocers to follow, but availability and accessibility of products that have more, that were formerly in a very niche or specialty domain are now much more mainstream.
Meg Major is the chief content editor for the Progressive Grocer publication.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Lots of managers want their employees to get along. Anyone who's ever been forced to go to a staff retreat or an awkward bowling night can relate to that. But what if being friends with your coworkers can actually make you better at your job? New research published in last month's Journal of Marketing suggests that's exactly the case, specifically for people in positions known as relationship managers. Gabe Gonzalez is a marketing professor at the Thunderbird School of Global Management and one of the authors. And Gabe, I must admit, I'm not exactly sure what a relationship manager is or what they do.
So a relationship manager can be, just to give you an idea of the concrete jobs, could be a salesperson, or it could be somebody who's in charge of serving a customer in some way, but they have to maintain this relationship over time, serve them over time. This job has really become complicated because if you can think of yourself, over time, customers have become much more sophisticated. For example, a salesperson arrives at a customer, and that person already knows all the alternatives that are in front of them. They know the prices and everything else, and it's much harder to deal with customers that way. What we find that happens with these kinds of people is that they are better at their job when they can arrive to the customer and say, hey, I've got a new way of solving your larger problems. And these customers are more interested in that.
It sounds kind of like a one-stop shop kind of operation.
It is. And in a lot of organizations, they refer to this as selling solutions.
And it sounds like, based on your research, that these relationship managers do their jobs better. It sounds like when they're friendly or at least on good working terms with the other people with whom they work.
Yeah, you know, that's really a big result of our research. We began to realize that these people can't do their job by themselves when we frame it this way, that they're not just selling products and prices, but they're selling solutions to customers. They don't have the full capacity or the resources or the knowledge at hand. And so what they really need most of all is the help of other people inside their organization that can provide information and cooperation.
Does that go back to them being sort of the one-stop shop? They need to know what Division X is doing. They need to know what HR is up to. They need to know what accounting is up to. They need to know what everything else is up to.
Yeah, they sure do. So knowledge is a big thing. They need to be able to access the latest knowledge inside their firm to really bring to bear the full capabilities of their company's resources and assets on the problems of their customers. But they also need cooperation. Many times they need to convince people to help them over which, you know, people over whom they have no authority whatsoever.
Now, I have to say that sort of on the, at least on the face of this, it seems like that just makes a lot of sense. Like that seems kind of intuitive.
It is. I mean, it is, but and there's a lot of research and a lot of writing in the business practice that has been done on this. But what we found that's really interesting is that most of this writing has then gone off and said, hey, you know, it's the informal part of your organization, the informal contacts, it's the hierarchy, the connections behind the hierarchy, the scene, that really matters. But what we found in our research is that, you know, it isn't just your informal ties by themselves that really impact performance. It's the way that you combine your friendships or informal ties with the formal relationships that your organization has set up for you.
In businesses that have these relationship managers, do you find that managers tend to sort of try to force these relationships, or do they kind of just sort of happen organically?
You know what I think, my co-authors and I have talked about this several times. You know what I think? I think these kinds of relationships happen haphazardly, and then the highest performers over time learn to broker information by taking information from one part of their company and then trading it with somebody else from information in another part of the company to get the things they need for their customers.
Do you think that this research will ultimately be used by companies to try to sort of figure out, okay, this is how we want our relationship managers in whatever capacity they are in our particular firm, this is how we want them to operate?
Yeah, I do. I think already organizations are starting to look at doing the kinds of things that you've talked about, you know, building their internal social networks. And they can do this through their own version of Facebook inside their organization. Organizations for the longest time have been trying to create more social environments where people meet each other through whether they be social events or other kind of events that you get to introduce other people in the organization to each other. I think what happens, though, is that firms have not been doing it with as much in as purposive a way as they have before. And I think our research can help inform the strategic choices that you can make about getting the most out of your informal relationships in the organization.
Do companies have to be careful about how they go about doing that, though? I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, like a happy hour one evening. It's another thing to have, you know, your workers doing trust falls, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think that's an important aspect of this research, is that we're not looking at friendships, for example, for friendship's sake. We're looking at friendships and their power to help us in our work performance.
That sounds so cunning, though, that, you know, you decide to make friends based on who can help you at work.
Yeah, it really does. And I think the point here is that in some instances, especially this idea of brokerage, you know, we're trading, but we're benefiting each other. Meaning I give you information that I learned from the finance department, and you're in marketing, and we're trading to help each other, because most organizations don't have really good communication programs within their own systems. You know, I think those kinds of structures, in order for them to be long-lived, meaning in order for them to be pretty set in, they have to be built, and most of the research shows this, they have to be built on trust.
Gabe Gonzalez is a professor of marketing at the Thunderbird School of Global Management. His research was published in the January edition of the Journal of Marketing. Gabe, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And that's it for today. Thanks to Nick Blumberg and Bruce Drummond for their help with today's show. If you missed anything, you can check it out online this afternoon, or you can podcast this and each week's show on the new KJZZ mobile app. It's free and available for download right this minute. Steve will be back next week. I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. NPR's Here and Now from Boston is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 12 noon.